On July 28, 2012, three peace activists, a painter, a Vietnam War veteran, and an elderly Catholic nun, broke into the Y-12 National Security Complex. The facility, known as the Fort Knox of Uranium, holds enough enriched uranium to destroy the world many times over. Dan Zak chronicles the plight of these three protesters against the wider backdrop of America's enduring relationship with nuclear weapons in his latest book called Almighty: Courage, Resistance, and Existential Peril in the Nuclear Age. And the history he presents suggests that just maybe the biggest threat to national security is the one on our own soil and of our own making. His book is published by Blue Rider Press. I'm very pleased it has brought Dan Zak to our show today. Hello.
Hi, Leonard.
You tell a story about meeting a woman in Japan that led to your writing this book?
Well, I wouldn't say it led to it, but it first introduced me to being aware of our nuclear weapons present and past in a way that I had not been before. I mean, I'm 32 years old. I was born into a world that was very fixated on nuclear weapons in 1983, but I came of age after the end of the Cold War, when the salience of nuclear weapons in the public consciousness had dropped off. But I met a young woman through basically a semester at sea, an exchange program, a fellowship in 2008, who at the end of the program, you know, said to me, you know, we had been friendly throughout the program. And then on the last day, as if she had unfinished business in discussing with me, said, you know, so Hiroshima. And I said, yes. And she said to me, how can we make sure this never happens again? And it totally blindsided me. I mean, it really revealed in one very short exchange how present that history is in Japanese culture and how marginalized it is in a way in American culture.
Even though most of the world's nuclear weapons are on our soil right now.
Right. We certainly possess, the United States and Russia possess about 92% of the remaining warheads on the planet, yes.
You intersperse the story of that protest I mentioned involving the three activists, Greg, a house painter, Megan, a Catholic nun, and a Vietnam War veteran named Michael, with the history of nuclear weapons. Why that approach?
Well, I think that this story needed to be told through individual humans. Because once you start talking about nuclear weapons, you start talking about military strategy, you get into the complicated jargonistic vocabulary of nuclear physics and techno-strategy, and I think people's eyes can glaze over, mine do at times when talking about that. So I really wanted to center the story around individuals, around people, and to show that how a chain reaction of actions and consequence through people kind of mirrors that chain reaction that happens at an atomic level in a nuclear detonation. So it was really just a way to make the story more human, more grounded in the real world, more emotional.
And you still do give us the science and the story of the development of nuclear weapons. But let's talk about the facility that they targeted. What was happening inside that facility?
Well, this is a facility that's called the Y-12 National Security Complex. It's in East Tennessee, just outside of Knoxville, in a city called Oak Ridge. And Y-12 was created in the 40s during the Manhattan Project. It was one of the key facilities that helped make the first atomic bombs during World War II. Its primary purpose was to enrich uranium to a weapons-grade point where it could be used in atomic bombs. And the uranium that was enriched at Y-12 is what was used in the bomb that was dropped on Hiroshima. And Y-12 continued its operations through the decades until today. And what happens today is not the enrichment of uranium, it's the processing and storing of uranium, and it is the manufacturing of the parts of the modern nuclear warhead that make it thermonuclear, that contribute a fusion effect to the weapon. So this building that these activists got to and defaced is the building that is the storage facility for all of this enriched uranium.
We tend to think of Manhattan Project as being conducted in Los Alamos, New Mexico, but obviously Tennessee and also Right here in New York, the nun, Megan Rice, grew up not far from Columbia University, where research was conducted for the Manhattan Project. She's an elderly person. Was she at all aware of secret government work that was happening near her home?
You know, she says she remembers secretive chatter, the aura of secrecy. She grew up about two blocks from the physics building on Columbia University's campus. And she lived in a building that was full of Columbia faculty and across the hall from a biophysicist at Columbia. So she remembers adults talking about her neighbor's work at Columbia, and there was an obscured nature to it, that the faculty there was working on the atom, that they were working with the Einstein theory. And she just remembers that something was going on in the neighborhood, but not knowing exactly what it was. And that made a deep impression on her, that secrecy. It started with being made uncomfortable by that, by families keeping secrets from each other and from neighbors.
My guest is Dan Zak, who's written a book called Almighty Courage, Resistance, and Existential Peril in the Nuclear Age. It's published by Blue Rider Press. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. The three people involved come from very different backgrounds. How did they find each other?
Well, I kind of tell the story of how their life took a certain path to lead them to each other. Essentially, they all convened around 2011, 2012, because they were moved to make a very bold and intrepid act of civil resistance. You mentioned Michael and Greg. Michael's a Vietnam veteran who lives in Washington. Greg is a longtime anti-nuclear activist who lives in Duluth, Minnesota, and is a house painter. And they had committed acts like this before. They had broken into weapons facilities, Greg starting in the 80s, and Michael starting after that. So they were kind of familiar with this strain of activism. Sister Megan got in touch with them because she finally retired after 40-plus years teaching in Africa. And rather than kind of enjoy her retirement back in the States, she decided to commit herself full-time to anti-nuclear activism. And she was very inspired by a similar action in 2010 in Washington State, when a group of activists broke into a weapons facility there. She went to their trial, and she was inspired, and she said, "How can I do this?" And one of the activists in that trial said, "Well, you should call Greg Borgiobet." And so she did, and that's how they kind of came together and started discussing, well, what is the next action? What is the next way we can register our complaint and our objection to the possession of nuclear weapons?
Was she also inspired by the activities of Father Daniel Berrigan, the Jesuit priest who was a member of Plowshares?
For sure. Both Berrigan, Philip and Daniel, committed, you know, the first of what they call these Plowshares actions, breaking into weapons facilities in 1980 in King of Prussia, Pennsylvania. And that started a whole kind of new strain of activism, where it wasn't just civil resistance. It was, this intrepid, unlawful, very dangerous type of action. Of course, the activists involved would not say it's unlawful because it's objecting to a crime and following a higher law. They started this movement, the Plowshares movement, and this break-in in Y-12 in 2012 is the most recent example of this type of movement action.
They're Catholics. Has the Catholic Church taken a stand on nuclear proliferation? Did it respond, the Vatican ever respond to the bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki?
Well, you know, it's funny. The official press release after the bombings of Japan, was kind of, funny and curious in its phrasing. It said that I'm paraphrasing, but it said that these bombings create, quote, an unfavorable impression, end quote, on the Vatican. So their language there was not very stark while registering displeasure with it. Through the years, the Vatican has essentially endorsed the nuclear deterrent. That is, the Vatican has endorsed that nuclear weapons can exist as long as they prevent conflict and bloodshed, which is what a lot of people think nuclear weapons do. Nukes make war inconceivable and therefore prevent war. But then with St. Francis, we see positions that are even more stark. The Vatican under St. Francis has been very public and very specific about its objection. It objects even to the possession of nuclear weapons, which is a strong statement that a lot of activists have taken great encouragement from.
On July 28, 2012, these three protesters arrived on the grounds of the Y-12 National Security Complex. It's also known as the Fort Knox of Uranium.
Yes. Yeah.
How do you get in?
Well, for them, it just involved about a one-mile hike in the middle of the night over a wooded ridge. This Y-12 facility is in a valley. And it involved cutting through four fences. One was a boundary fence, and then three were fences that surrounded the storage facility that were alarmed, wired with sensors. So what it took to get as far as they did was essentially just bolt cutters that they bought from a hardware store. These were otherwise conventional chain link fences, and they cut their way through and got there all the way to this building, realized that the building they were at is exactly where they wanted to be, and then they spray painted biblical messages on the outside of it, threw human blood on it, and chipped away at the corner with sledgehammers to essentially begin the actual work of transforming swords into plowshares, that command from the Book of Isaiah and the Bible. They wanted to begin that work literally. And then they essentially waited to be arrested.
And where did they get the blood?
The blood was drawn from a few activists that had remained in storage. Normally, in these types of actions, the activists use their own blood. In this case, they used blood from other activists, including one man who had died years ago, and his blood was stored, who had participated at protests at Y-12. So it was symbolic in a way that the blood they were throwing on this storage facility, part of it came from a man who objected and protested at this site for many years but died a few years ago. So it came from other activists.
You say they cut through fences. There were alarms there. Why weren't they apprehended sooner? You write that 5 days before the break-in, it was announced that the Y-12 facility was cutting as many as 34 security police officers. So were there just not very many people on duty?
Well, these officers had not yet been cut. The announcement was made, but they had not been let go. The real issue was the alarm system and what had been a culture of complacency that had descended upon the facility. You know, there were upwards of 1,000 alarms, false alarms, every day at this facility. And these false alarms were caused by wildlife, by foliage, by, you know, a breeze that would knock a door open. So the central alarm station at Y-12 was used to 1,000-plus false alarms every day. And that can kind of take people off their game. So what's a couple more when you're used to 1,000? And so there was not an aggressive reaction to alarms that essentially show that there was a pathway of intrusion, that one fence was being cut, the next one was being cut. And when you layer on top of that the fact that many security cameras were out of commission, that there was a maintenance backlog, that things were not fixed in an appropriate time fashion, you had a facility that was ripe for peace activists to kind of just wander into.
Earlier on our show, we were talking about the changes in policy and the amount of money that's been spent to prevent another 9/11 from happening. And one of the concerns is the development of a dirty bomb, which probably would be less effective than people fear, but that's a whole other issue. It sounds to me like you might be able to break into this place and get a little uranium and throw it into your dirty bomb.
Well, I mean, there are people in the immediate aftermath, security experts in the immediate aftermath of this incident, who said with the uninterrupted time that these activists had, terrorists, people bent on sabotage, could have blown a hole in the wall of this storage facility, gotten their hands on enriched uranium, and, in some cases, if things went perfectly, you could drop one chunk of uranium on the other and cause some kind of nuclear detonation. Now, the chances of that happening are wildly, wildly small. I mean, the storage facility's walls itself were designed to withstand the impact of a jet. So this is not an easy building to get into. And then, of course, if you do get into it, it's a matter of getting the material. So people say, you know, experts, people I talk to in the Department of Energy say that, you know, they weren't, these activists were not getting anywhere near in compromising this material. There was, you know, chances of saboteurs doing that is infinitesimally small. But one could argue that it also is highly improbable that an 82-year-old Catholic sister could get as far as she did.
And when they were found, the arresting officer didn't pull his gun. Was he punished for treating this as something not all that important or not all that scary?
Well, he was fired. Yeah, there was one gentleman, a security police officer at Y-12, who was dispatched to figure out why these alarms kept going off. So the security apparatus sent one person to a zone of the facility grounds that was clearly showing a pathway of intrusion. And so when he got there, he saw three people. Initially thought that they were part of a construction or painting crew, but then saw how they were dressed, how they looked. He saw the biblical messages spray painted on the wall. And, you know, from his 30 years in nuclear security, he's dealt with these kinds of protesters. So he determined that these were peace activists, and he radioed for backup. Now, plenty of people have criticized him for not jumping immediately from his vehicle, for not drawing his weapon, for not immediately ordering them on the ground and cuffing them. He made a choice to treat the scenario more calmly than some might have liked him to. Of course, Sister Megan credits him with saving her life for not escalating the situation into something that could have, resolved in shots fired. Of course, the security contractor and government officials were not pleased with his reaction, thought it should have been more aggressive, and so he was fired. Although you could argue that he was set up to fail because he was one person who was sent to this area where there were three people waiting.
I'm talking with Dan Zak, a reporter for The Washington Post and author of Almighty: Courage, Resistance, and Existential Peril in the Nuclear Age. The book is published by Blue Rider Press. We will continue our conversation after this. And we are back with Dan Zak, Z-A-K. His book, Almighty: Courage, Resistance, and Existential Peril in the Nuclear Age. It's published by Blue Rider Press. Did you cover this story at all for The Washington Post?
I did. I wrote a long feature story. It was about a 9,000-word story in April of 2013. And, the story, the incident was passed to me by a colleague of mine who covered national security. I'm a general assignment reporter. And as soon as I realized kind of the implications of this incident and the necessary context, I decided with editors that it deserved a kind of long takeout. And it ran in April 2013, and I started on the book about a year later.
What was the response, the public response, and the government response to the break-in?
Well, of course, Washington reacted by holding congressional hearings, which chiefly allowed elected officials to kind of wag their finger and ask how could this happen and what if these people had been terrorists. Washington was embarrassed, outraged and embarrassed. The Department of Energy and its agency, the National Nuclear Security Administration, it was hugely embarrassing. And it was also embarrassing at a local level at this facility, which, as you mentioned, you know, prides itself on being referred to in part or in whole as the Fort Knox of uranium. Having three peace activists break in like they did was humiliating.
Including a 90-year-old nun.
Right. Well, 82 at the time. Oh. She's 86 now. That's hugely embarrassing. And, you know, part of the mystique of this place is its reputation for it being impenetrable. And here you have people essentially walking in to this storage facility. So, you know, there were changes made locally. They put more concertina wire up. They made sure that maintenance backlogs for broken cameras were fixed within 24 hours. They retrained their security force to deal with this type of, peaceful but still very dangerous infiltration. So there were changes. And then, of course, there were the kind of four congressional hearings that were just kind of shaming sessions for the Department of Energy and the National Nuclear Security Administration.
Weren't the activists also thanked by some government officials for exposing the security weakness?
Yeah, exactly. Sister Megan and Michael, who are living in D.C., attended some of these hearings. And in one of them, a congressman asked Sister Megan to stand up and said, "Thank you for exposing these problems." Of course, then you have another congressman who's saying, "Why are these people allowed to be here when they, are committed this felony? They should be in jail somewhere." So they were received in various ways on Capitol Hill.
Well, they were charged. What were they charged with?
Ultimately, they were charged with destruction of government property over the amount of $1,000. And the more serious charge was intending to endanger the national defense, which is somewhat of a rare charge to level against civilians. It stems from the Sabotage Act of the U.S. Criminal Code. So they were essentially, the government said, your break-in, your crime, you were trying to affect and harm national security and American safety.
And what, during Sister Megan's testimony, she compared the KKK to Al-Qaeda and the U.S. What was she trying to say there?
Well, these activists, Sister Megan, Michael, Gregg, and other anti-nuclear activists, some of them believe that the United States is perpetually guilty of war crimes, that the mere possession of nuclear weapons, the intent to use them in certain scenarios, is a war crime. And they sometimes go as far to say that the U.S. is essentially a terrorist organization because nuclear deterrence relies on projecting a level of terror about these weapons and what they can do. Their rhetoric can be extreme to the average citizen, but it was on full display in their trial, particularly during their sentencing hearing when they were given the chance to speak for the record.
And what were they sentenced to?
Well, it varied. Sister Megan got just under 3 years, and Michael and Gregg, who have a significantly longer rap sheet, got around 6 years each.
Are they serving time right now?
No. In fact, they were released about 14 months ago. They appealed, their lawyers appealed, and a court of appeals overturned that sabotage charge, that most serious charge. And by then, they had served about 2 years total, just awaiting trial and during trial and awaiting sentencing. So they had served their time for the lesser charge. And activists saw that as a great victory. This appeals court said this was not an act of sabotage. This was an act of protest.
And after the judge delivered the sentences, he said, "I wish you the best of luck, and I do appreciate your good works, and I hope you will continue them." An odd thing to say.
Yeah, well, the judge, he came from Kentucky. He came down for this trial. It's a trial unlike anything that he had heard before. And he was a very interesting character in all this because he, I think the mental and intellectual challenges of this case were pretty challenging for everyone involved. Members of the spectators in the courtroom, the judge himself, and he felt that, especially during sentencing, these crimes are technically described as crimes of violence. And so he found himself having to impose sentencing or dealing with sentencing guidelines that pertain more to, violent criminals, to terrorists. But he had to apply them in this case to three, pacifists, essentially. And he saw some conflict to that. And I could tell just from watching that he was not fully satisfied with the way that his hands were tied in this case. So he used his final address to essentially say, I wish you would go back to the political process, the lawful process that you seem to have given up on. And so he sentenced them, but still recognized for the record that these are three people who do tremendous good in the world.
Funding of nuclear weapons programs has continued ever since the end of World War II. Are we trying to build a better bomb?
Well, some people say we are. We are embarking on a $1 trillion modernization of our arsenal. The number of warheads in our inventory has gone down over the years by 85%. Spending is going up, though, as we, are at a point in the cycle of life of these weapons where we have to refurbish them. And as we refurbish them, there are people who say that we are introducing new capabilities to them. which they think is a violation of the Non-Proliferation Treaty, and which they think is a destabilizing effort, that, you know, we should not be introducing new capabilities, we should not be refurbishing these bombs, because we essentially committed 40-plus years ago to getting rid of them. But we and the other 8 nuclear-armed nations are all embarking on some form of modernization program that will ensure that this arsenal is functional through most of the rest of this century.
American atmospheric scientist Michael Mills once said, if India and Pakistan each exchange 50 nuclear bombs in a regional war, the smoke and fallout would trigger a global famine that would kill 2 billion people. Is that global connectedness well understood by the people who run the weapons programs?
You know, I think it is. The problem, I think, is that, you know, when you run the labs, the plants, the military installations that deal with these weapons, a lot of the conversation centers around military strategy, delivering weapons, where to target them, how many we need to accomplish military objectives. And I think it's easy to drift away from what these weapons actually do. So there has been a movement, especially abroad in the past 6 years, to bring the public conversation back to the humanitarian consequences of these weapons. And, yeah, Michael Mills, that scenario that climatologists and other people say, that, you know, nuclear weapons essentially need to remind us or can remind us that we really are all in this together. Because even if there's a regional nuclear war between, as you mentioned, India and Pakistan, the consequences are global.
And wouldn't India, let's say India dropped the bomb, wouldn't it be killing its own people, or in a similar situation in the small world of the Middle East, if Israel and Iran got involved in any kind of nuclear conflict, the fallout would be killing people in each of those countries?
Well, yeah, and that's exactly why activists and many people object to the existence of nuclear weapons, because they violate the laws of war. They cannot distinguish between civilians and the military. The effects of a nuclear detonation cannot be contained in time and space. And so when you have countries like India and Pakistan talking about developing and maintaining tactical nuclear weapons that can be used on the battlefield, you know, you might say that there is no such thing as a tactical nuclear weapon, that any nuclear detonation would have effects that move far beyond any kind of battlefield, if not immediately, then in the future, because of the radiological materials that are dispersed.
You're right, I'm quoting, at something called NukeFest, the nickname for a nuclear policy conference. Attendees order specialty coffee drinks called Go Ballistic, which is a triple shot of espresso, and the thermonuclear, a latte with brown sugar and cinnamon syrup. Are they not taking nuclear weapons very seriously?
Well, I think they're taking it seriously. I just, as an outsider who was attending conferences like these, you know, to me that was an example of how easy it is to, you know, kind of fall toward glibness inside a bubble, that bubble being Washington, that bubble being experts in nuclear weapons and nuclear strategy. You know, you tend to start behaving a certain way and start seeing the world in a limited way, I think. And as an outsider, I, you know, the reason I included that in the book is because it is a little shocking to an outsider. I mean, it was meant just as a joke, not anything seriously. But, you know, there are plenty of these types of events around Washington. You could go to a panel or some kind of meeting on nuclear weapons every day in Washington if you wanted to, sponsored by think tanks, or maybe a hearing on Capitol Hill or some kind of conference where the discussions are very, you know, they're full of jargon, and the entry, you know, for an average citizen trying to understand it is very high, I think. And so what I tried to do with this book, and you cited one example there with this conference, is to, you know, write about it in a way that the average reader can understand and gain entry to.
And you also talk about things like what happened in 1983 when one of the Soviet Union satellites confused the sun's reflection of the clouds as a missile launch, and it's only because a lieutenant colonel decided not to trust that information that we didn't have a major nuclear war. The Non-Proliferation of Nuclear Weapons Treaty was signed in 1968. Has it brought about positive changes? Who hasn't signed it?
Well, there are several nations that haven't signed it. Israel, India, Pakistan, North Korea dropped out of it. The global inventory of warheads has gone down. That's a success. The fissile material that was loose after the collapse of the Soviet Union has, by and large, been secured, although not totally. You could say that was a success. But when the treaty was signed, there were 5 nuclear-armed nations. Now there are 9. That's not a success. And now, especially as all those nations embark on these modernization programs, you might say that this treaty is not working like it should, which is why there is this aforementioned movement to focus public conversation on the humanitarian consequences and to get countries to sign a pledge to close what they call the legal gap in the Non-Proliferation Treaty, which does not expressly outlaw nuclear weapons. Nuclear weapons are the only weapons of mass destruction that are not outlawed internationally. And so this movement wants to get countries together to host a convention, a weapons ban convention, where they say, okay, we are establishing a norm that says nuclear weapons are illegal to possess. And as you might imagine, the United States, Great Britain, other nuclear-armed nations are not pleased with this.
Dan Zak is a reporter for The Washington Post. His book, Almighty, Courage, Resistance, and Existential Peril in the Nuclear Age, is published by Blue Rider Press. Thank you so much for being on our show.